Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
As I've been reading the new latest book, it's been great to dip into the stories of all of them, actually, but I've been reading the latest one. I've been really enjoying, the characters, certainly, and the story, but it's just how amazingly strong people can be in the worst of times, it seems, and given the worst of circumstances. That was, like, one of the big takeaways for me. So for those of you unfamiliar, I think the three books that Natasha has done so far are the Mr. Rosenblum Dreams in English. The second one would be The House at
Tyneford.
Tyneford, which was a New York Times bestseller, made it to the indie bestseller list as well. Both of which talk about families. Actually, I guess all three really touch upon the idea of families coming, Jewish families coming from. Really fleeing the Germans from the war during the World War II, and then settling in England and what all that means. The last book touches upon that as well, but the last one does a great job of especially a very, very, very strong woman character who really does the things that she has to do to make it in the world, and especially in support of her family. So without any further ado, I'd just like to introduce Natasha Solomon.
My new book, The Gallery of Vanished Husbands, is about Juliet Montagu, whose husband has disappeared sort of 7 years before the novel starts. And she's got two young children, she's a single mother, and up to this point, she's done everything that's expected of her. She's trying so hard to be respectable in her small Jewish community in the south of London. And then on her 30th birthday, something changes. She's tired of respectability, and she knows she needs to do something different. And she's been saving up all her birthday money to go and buy a refrigerator. It's late 1950s England, and she doesn't have very much money, but she's going to enter into the modern world. She's going to buy a refrigerator. But she's walking along the Bayswater Road in London, which is one of our most famous streets, where they have put out sort of portraits and paintings on the sidewalk. And she's distracted by a picture, and she ends up blowing all her savings on a portrait of herself instead. And I might just read you a little bit from the beginning, and then I'll read you a little bit more, and then I'll talk a bit, and then I'll ask to take questions, because then I find that I can actually talk about what you're interested in rather than just kind of, you know, talking about umbrellas endlessly. Catalogue item 1. Woman with a bowl of apples, also known as the fridge. Charlie Fuss Oil, oil and canvas, 26 inches by 46 inches, 1958. So I should say that the novel is actually structured like a gallery catalogue. Because Juliet's commission of this portrait of herself sort of changes the course of her life. And each chapter sort of hinges on a painting of Juliet at every phase of life. And this first chapter is about the sort of the painting that changes this. It was Juliet Montagu's 30th birthday. This did not worry her unduly, although she conceded that other women in her position might well be disconcerted. She examined her feelings with her usual frankness, but concluded that she felt just as befuddled sliding out of bed at 6:30 as she had the day before. And when she dressed the children for school, she felt no sudden urge to reach for the cooking sherry. 30, Juliet decided, was the point in her life when a woman is at her handsomest. She may not have the flush of her teens or the swagger of her 20s, but at 30, a woman has a directness in her eye. Juliet Montagu did anyhow. She knew exactly what she wanted. She wanted to buy a refrigerator. The morning was wet and unseasonably cold, but Juliet tried not to take it personally. It seemed unfair to have rain on one's birthday, and yet she supposed every day was somebody's birthday, and if it never rained, England would be a desert, and Leonard wouldn't have anywhere to sail his model boat. Resigned, she buttoned her mackintosh, fastened her scarf tight about her throat, and darted around puddles the colour of milky tea as she hurried to the station, uncertain, as usual, if she would make her train. Juliet lost time, mislaying minutes and even the odd hour, the way her father spilt loose change from his trouser pockets. The freezing rain sliced against her cheeks, and in half a minute the wind blew her wretched umbrella inside out. Yet by the time the train was pulling into Charing Cross, the winter's morning had been transformed into a spring afternoon. The laundered sky stretched a taut blue above Trafalgar Square, while shuffling pigeons lined up along Nelson's outstretched arms to dry out in the sunshine like so many pairs of socks. The high puffs of white cloud looked just like the ones Leonard drew in the pictures that Juliet pinned to the corkboard in the kitchen. She jumped on board the first bus going by, which turned out to be going exactly the wrong direction, but it was such a lovely afternoon she didn't mind in the least. The prospect of a walk beside the park was just right for a birthday. She pictured the neat pound notes and tumbling coins inside her purse and felt a tingle of exhilaration in her chest. 21 guineas. She'd not had that much money to spend since George left. That had happened on her birthday too, and she thought as she dodged the spray thrown up by a rushing taxi. At first it had not been such a bad birthday. She'd not known then that George wasn't coming back. She'd only been irritated he'd forgotten it was her birthday. Not a card, not even a bunch of flowers from the garden. He'd given her one the year before, and she'd been touched by the bouquet of black tulips, pleased he'd remembered they were her favourite, until she'd looked out of the kitchen window and seen he'd lopped the heads off all the flower pots in her pots by the back door. Her mind tripped down familiar lanes. If only he'd left a note. He could have written it inside a birthday card, killing two birds with one stone. Darling, many happy returns. By the way, I'm off. So, Juliet is sort of caught between the sort of the medieval and the modern. And what I mean by that is that in her conservative community, because her husband has disappeared, she's unable to divorce him. And Jewish law, if a woman, basically only men can divorce women, and without a piece of paper called a get, a woman remains still married to her husband. And because Juliet's husband has vanished and she has no idea where he is, she's fairly sure that he's not dead, because he takes with him a painting of her. And it tends to be that before men are murdered, they don't sort of steal random paintings first. So she's pretty sure that he's alive, but she has absolutely no idea where he's gone or why. And because she's not divorced, she's known as an aguna, which sort of translates roughly as sort of a chained woman. And she's stuck. She's sort of unable to move on. And the sort of community she's grown up in is conservative, and she's very fond of her parents, and she doesn't want to hurt them, and she's sort of worried about sort of the act of rebellion. On the other hand, by the time the book starts, she just can't do it anymore. And when she's painted by this young artist, Charlie Fussell, who she sees along the Bayswater Road, and he's from a rather different sort of social background from her. His parents are very privileged. They sort of have this beautiful country house. And his mother, Valerie, is a sort of a woman who sort of speaks in superlatives. She's always dying for something and always absolutely famished. And Juliet doesn't quite understand Charlie or fit into his family, and yet he sees in her partly. I mean, Charlie's in his early 20s and he's just left art school, and the 60s are just starting to swing, but not for people in Juliet's community. And it's sort of that juxtaposition between the sort of 60s in London, where the sort of modern world as we know it is really starting, and yet this sort of small town, suburban London, where really the 60s are very much like the 50s, and sort of neighbours watch one another out of greying curtains, and they don't like change very much, thank you, please. And Juliet is really caught between the two. So in the world she's grown up with, as an aguna, she's very much sort of on the edge of her community. And the men are both intrigued and a little terrified of her, because obviously as a married woman who's tasted the delights of sex and yet is now not having any, she clearly might be unable to resist their charms, no matter how elderly or portly, and they're both sort of fascinated and a little bit terrified by this, so make sure to keep their distance and a good bagel between them, and the wives watch her just in case. And so she's very much an outsider there. And yet when she sort of moves into the sort of the 60s scenes, she feels sort of rather a prude. And the sort of the young men like Charlie, they sort of, you know, they're very fond of Juliet, but she's a mother. She's got two young children. And she's sort of aware of a gulf between them. And I suppose it's the outsider is sort of a figure that I'm always drawn to. And I seem to sort of write again and again different kinds of outsiders and different ways of being isolated. And the figure of the Aguna is one that I've known a little bit about personally, in that my husband David, his grandmother Rosie was an Aguna in Glasgow in the 1940s and 50s, and her husband disappeared one day, leaving her with two young children. The Gorbals were a bit like, I suppose, the equivalent of the Projects in the US. But Rosie was sort of utterly determined that she would give her children a better life. And she did, and she sort of ran a hair salon known as Rosie's, and, you know, if you got your hair done, that's where you went. And her son, Bernard, my father-in-law, was the first in his family ever to go to university. But the story that my mother-in-law, Maureen, always tells me is that so Rosie never found her husband, and she never got divorced, she never remarried, and she never had a boyfriend, despite the fact that her husband left her in her 20s. And, I mean, she lived till her 70s. And Maureen went round one day to pick up Rosie and take her to work, as she did every day. And she found Rosie sitting at her kitchen table, wearing her hat and coat, and drinking a small glass of sherry. And Rosie really didn't drink. And Rosie said, "I've just found out that my husband's dead." And even after all that time, after sort of getting on for sort of 50 years, the sort of his death still had the power to shake her like that. And that scene really, for me, was a kind of opening point of the novel, that I sort of had an end and a sort of a sense in my mind of, I wanted to kind of reverse engineer what had the life been like. And there was a sort of a Gallery of Vanished Husbands was a real thing. There's a newspaper column ran in the Jewish Daily Forward, a newspaper published out of New York. And they published for sort of many decades sort of a rogues gallery lineup of errant husbands, and sort of there'd be sort of maybe a dozen photographs of these men. And I'll see if I can find a little description of the gallery. I won't find it. I can never find passages in my own novels. So there's sort of a dozen pictures of men, and they all stare rather proudly out at the camera, because these are photographs taken before the crime, and, you know, with these fantastic moustaches kind of caterpillaring along the sort of top lip. And underneath, there's sort of two or three very terse lines sort of telling you that there's a sort of a woman left behind with maybe sort of two children, left in sort of uncomfortable circumstances, and they'd very much like sort of husband to return. And it just doesn't say anything. And I just thought, so behind this photograph and these lines that say nothing, there's a whole family tragedy and a story. And I wanted to know what that story was. And I resented the fact that the women weren't allowed to speak. And Juliet, in the story, there's sort of a moment where this sort of particularly the family doctor, to his sort of joy, thinks that George has returned. And Juliet, he's terribly pleased, and Juliet can't understand his joy at the return of her husband, that he's abandoned the children at this point for nearly a decade, and the doctor was there when her sort of her son sort of developed nightmares and is unable to sleep because his father has gone. And she's saying, you know, why do you want this man to come back? Well, because he makes you respectable again. And Juliet finds it so strange that her parents place an advert in the Jewish Daily Forward with the help of a private detective in their quest to find George. And at least, I mean, they'd like George to come back, or if not that, at least to issue a get so that Juliet could be free and marry again. Because if she's married, then at last Juliet will be respectable. And Juliet just, she's so uncomfortable with this. And I suppose I was uncomfortable with looking at these tiny descriptions and thinking, I want to give one of these women to imagine a woman a bit like Rosie and give her a voice back. And so most of the novel is told from Juliet's point of view, though we do glimpse into her parents, because it's one of the things that sort of Juliet, she's terribly fond of her parents, even though they come from sort of very different worlds. So to give you a little sense of her parents, I'll read you a little paragraph. Her parents had given her the last 10 guineas, this is towards the refrigerator, at dinner on Saturday night. Mr. Green slid the notes across the table to Leonard. Keep them safe for your mother now. While Mrs. Green watched her daughter a little unhappily and wondered between mouthfuls of chicken, are you sure you wouldn't prefer to buy a nice bit of jewellery for your birthday? Juliet shook her head, determined to be sensible. She knew that her newly minted practicality made her parents sad. On the one hand, they were terribly proud of the way she managed. It's not easy what you do, Fidget, said her father, toasting her with his weekly schnapps. On the other, she knew that they missed the decidedly impractical girl who yearned for tennis lessons one week and a vegetable patch in which to grow rhubarb the next. They wanted her to be showered with golden trinkets and not scrimp for fridges. One Friday evening, Mrs. Green confessed to Juliet that she believed herself to be responsible for what she preferred to call the unfortunate business. She confessed, after drinking an uncharacteristic schnapps, that she believed it was entirely due to Juliet's name. They'd intended to call her Ethel. A good, sensible name for the sort of no-nonsense young woman who liked to weed and wore brown shoes and never forgot to telephone her mother before Shabbos. But bobbing amid the flotsam and jetsam of good feeling following the birth of her only child, Mrs. Green had an attack of romance, the only one she suffered in her life, if truth be told, and found herself naming the baby Juliet. Somehow, a girl called Juliet seemed destined for that particular type of drama. What was it called? Iambic, yes. Juliet's were destined via iambic dramas in the way that Ethel's were not. And Mrs. Green recognises something really unsavoury in her daughter and something really not respectable at all, ambition. And she can't understand why her daughter wants to live an interesting life and meet different people, when the whole point of the Jewish calendar and living in a pleasant small town is that you can sort of totally remove the unexpected and the sort of unrespectable from your life. And for me, one of the pleasures of writing this book is that it takes you through the whole course of Juliet's life. And it's mostly chronological, and it starts when she's 30, though we glimpse her sort of earlier on as well. But by the beginning of the book, Juliet gets terribly frustrated with her mother. She's very fond of her, and she's aware that her choices have made things quite uncomfortable for her parents sometimes in their community, but she can't help being irritated with her mother. And by the end, Juliet is in her 70s, and her children are incredibly irritated with her, a fact she seems unable to stop, and wishes somehow she could sort of go back in time and talk about this with her mother. But of course, you know, her mother by this time is long gone. And I really enjoyed that sort of way of examining relationships at different points in life. And sort of, I found that the structure of the book just gave me sort of tremendous flexibility of kind of going to the key moments in Juliet's life. And it was quite a sort of a different experience for me writing this book, because I was pregnant at the time with my first child, and the manuscript pages were sort of growing in time with my belly, and it was really touch and go with the manuscript or baby would be delivered first. And in the end, it was the manuscript, but only by about 4 days, and only because Luke was late. And it was quite strange because I'd had in my mind this sort of this ending that I was going to write, and I didn't quite get to it before Luke was born, and I had a trapped nerve in my back, and I couldn't sit, and I could only kind of lie on one side or pace, and that's a very hard way to write. And so I said to my editor, you know, I can't finish off this last bit. And she said, fine. And then she got back to me a couple of days later, having read the book, and said, are you sure? Because I think it's finished. I was like, no, don't argue with a crazy pregnant lady. I'm going to write the ending once. And she was like, that's fine. Let's talk in a few weeks' time. And then Luke was born. And then I went back to the book and I reread it. And I thought, yeah, she was right. It is. It's finished. And it was a very strange experience because, unsurprisingly, I think this book, more than the other two, is slightly preoccupied with themes of motherhood. And some of my friends who are mothers who've read the book have been a little bit judgy about Juliet's mothering skills. But all I can say is, you know, paragons of motherhood would make for really tedious fiction. And I think sort of a lot of my concerns about sort of balancing sort of one's own desires and sort of creativity and ambition with also wanting to be a good mother, I kind of, you know, there's nothing like worrying it out through a novel. And yet when I went back and was editing the book, I found often Juliet's experiences were very different from mine. And there was a moment where I thought, should I change them? And then I thought, no, you know, I know Juliet terribly well. She's a great friend of mine. But her experiences are different, and they're unique, and that's they're different to her, and that's okay. And I think this book, probably because of the way I wrote it, and then the way I edited it, with sometimes this tiny creature asleep by my feet, sometimes asleep on my shoulder, with me kind of sort of typing with one hand, which is also not very comfortable. It feels like a real sort of family affair, and I have quite intense feelings, I think, about this book. It definitely feels like part of the family. Does anyone have any questions? Because I'm talking a lot, and then I can answer a little bit about the things maybe you're interested in. Is that, yeah?
No, I wasn't.
Gentleman was asking about the term of aguna and whether it's still a problem today. And yes, it very much is. And still today, if you get married in a Jewish ceremony and you're of the Jewish faith, if you're getting divorced, you need a get. And otherwise, technically, under Jewish law, you remain married. And I mean, it's sort of, I think particularly in Israel, it can be a problem. And a recent study said that up to 70% of women were anxious that if they didn't agree to less favourable divorce terms, that their husbands would threaten them with get refusal. And it means that you are sort of chained to a dead marriage. I mean, to me, it is something that is... It does seem rather medieval in the modern world. And I think that's one of the things that sort of so intrigued me, is that in a time in the 60s where we really feel the modern world is beginning, here is a woman who is really stuck because of sort of an ancient law. And despite the fact that she has really lost her faith and wants to... She has sort of no interest left in God, that's irrelevant. Her life is still sort of shaped by this. And I mean, one of the things that I particularly enjoyed in this book, I mean, it was really interesting sort of researching the Jewish aspects and the community that I wanted to create. It's slightly different from the community in my earlier two books, which are very much the sort of Bohemian, German, Hungarian Jewish refugees who emigrate to the UK to sort of escape Europe and the Second World War. This Jewish community is slightly different. It's more of kind of Russian and Eastern European, and it's people who came to the UK at the turn of the 20th century escaping pogroms. And so they're kind of fourth generation already by the time we get to the sort of the 1960s. They're sort of assimilated, but almost within little cities within the city. And the community is actually based on my husband's family's community in Glasgow. And I really wanted that his parents and their friends, when they read this book, they would absolutely sort of recognise themselves and their community. But I'm married to a Scotsman, and I daren't write about Glasgow. Then I think my husband might vanish too. So I transplanted that community and put it to sort of Chislehurst in the south of London, where I'm sort of much more comfortable at kind of writing about. But I also had sort of great fun researching the art world, and I wanted to write about art in a way that it really felt like sort of a character and a personality. And I mean, the book is also a love story, and Juliet falls in love with this sort of war artist, Max, who's a war artist without a war, but he's sort of been so traumatized by sort of painting the Second World War as a young man, as sort of one of these sort of war artists attached to regiments and sort of painting these awful sort of scenes, that he's now sort of stuck, and he's retreated into his little house in the woods, which is sort of inspired by the kind of the Bloomsbury set and the sort of beautiful sort of painted houses that they had. And she sort of, Juliet rather falls in love with Max before meeting him by seeing his paintings. But all of my novels, I sort of write a little bit about Dorset, the sort of really beautiful sort of southern county where I'm from. And it sort of also features in both Mr. Rosenblum and in The House at Tyneford. But whilst in those books, the characters are instantly, like me, kind of entranced by the sort of the magic of the countryside, Juliet's a city girl who's really not keen by mud and things that wriggle. And it's only when she sort of begins to fall in love with Max, the man, as well as Max, the artist, that she discovers the beauty of Dorset. But it was really fun for me writing about the countryside in two different ways in the novel. First, by somebody who's actually quite revolted by it, and then somebody who gradually sort of succumbs to its charms. And it's funny, I suppose I can see the paintings that I've written about. Sort of, to me, they're absolutely real. And they are very vivid. Some are inspired by paintings in my family or paintings that sort of I know well. So, for instance, again, my husband's family, never tell me anything unless you sort of think that it might turn up in a novel in a couple of years' time. So my husband's family had this lovely little factory known as the Glasgow Optical Company, where they ground lenses. And David's grandfather, Jack, didn't like to charge people of the cloth for spectacles. So all the prayers in Scotland were in focus, thanks to Jack. Didn't matter whether you were a rabbi or a nun, he would sort of give you free spectacles. And a painting of my mother-in-law when she was a little girl was traded by a rabbi whose daughter was an artist in exchange for a pair of specs. And I combined this portrait with another painting that was also traded for actually a couple of pairs of specs by an artist who features in the book called John McLaughlin Milne. And he was down on his luck, and he and Jack came to an arrangement for specs for this rather beautiful painting of boats in Saint-Tropez. And then a couple of years later, John McLaughlin Milne found his luck again, and this painting is now incredibly valuable and is sort of my parents-in-law sort of frequently lend it to galleries for exhibitions. And I love that incident, and I love the character of John McLaughlin Milne. He was a sort of hard-drinking Glaswegian who came out west for a while and I think was a very bad cowboy. A painter/cowboy, it seems quite unlikely. And then he went to Saint-Tropez and I think drank a lot of wine and ate a lot of lobster before going back to Scotland. That was probably why he lost his money. He'd sort of at that point sort of spent it all on lobster. And I thought he'd be a really intriguing character, and he sort of paints Juliet as a little girl. And so I like kind of magpie-like, I sort of combined those incidents. Whilst others For instance, there was a wonderful exhibition in London last year of Lucian Freud paintings. I find Lucian Freud a really uncomfortable artist, the way he sort of confronts the human body. It's the rawness of it. I admire them, I think, without liking the paintings, but the series that I do very much like are some paintings he did of his mother. His father had died and his mother was widowed, and he thought his mother was quite depressed, and he had quite an uneasy relationship with her and didn't really want to sort of talk about it. So he sent a taxi round to pick up his mother and take her to his studio, and he painted her every day for a year. And I thought the sort of, whilst we sort of quite expect in a way that kind of frisson of sort of male artists painting female subject, that, and it's sort of, it's one thing being painted when you're in your 20s, your 30s, your 40s, but I think it's quite different to be painted in your 70s. I think that takes a boldness and an unflinching nature, which Juliet absolutely has. And she and Leonard, I don't want to give too much away, but they're sort of, she has a difficult relationship with her children. I don't think Juliet would be an easy person to have as a mother. But for me, I knew that sort of inspired by the Lucian Freud series, that one of the most important paintings in the book had to be when Leonard painted his mother. And I thought that was a very different relationship of a sort of a son painting his mother and a son painting his mother in her 70s, when, you know, she's in at a different phase of life. My mum, who's an early reader of my books, says that I'm fascinated with old age. And she's like, why do you always write about old people? But I do. I think it's sort of, I've realised that kind of it's this sort of the bookends of life really intrigue me. I'm fascinated by teenagers and by people later on in life. And I think that was the joy of me for me of this, was being able to really look at a woman at every stage of her life and sort of go with her on that whole journey and see how relationships with her family change through that. And it's a woman's life really through paintings and sort of the catalogue. And it's not just about Dorset. She also ends up, the sort of search for George takes her to California as well. And my publisher initially, my US publisher, was sort of, they were a bit sort of uncertain. It's like, why, you know, you're terribly English, you know, why do you need to write about America? We have lots of writers doing that. I said, well, I know. I said, just trust me. And in the end, they were happy because it's a British person's view of America. She comes as a tourist and she comes to the US in the 60s. And at that point, Britain's only just out of, it's only been out of rationing 10 years before. And we sort of talk about the swinging 60s, but they aren't swinging in Chislehurst in the south of London. It's just as grey as it was before. And I think that the shock for her of coming to America, where she just feels that she's walked into kind of a piece of pop art, and just going into the stores, which are full of food and colour in a way that the ones in England just aren't yet, that I think it's sort of, hopefully I capture something again, the outsider looking in, that maybe sort of you know, somebody else wouldn't necessarily see. Does anyone else have any other questions?
Question.
Yeah.
It seems like you were talking about your American publisher, that you have different title for your book in English, in England and America. Is there a reason?
Yes, I think the first book, Mr. Rosenblum, it was called in the UK Mr. Rosenblum's List, and I think they felt it was too close to Schindler's List, and sort of maybe set off, I don't know, was too similar. And then the second book, I think the novel in the Viola, they felt was a bit sort of esoteric, really, and wanted sort of a simpler title that would sort of set, that, you know, it is a country house novel inspired by you know, books like sort of Rebecca, Jane Eyre, Remains of the Day, and they wanted to make that quite clear to readers. But this book, I was adamant that I wanted, The Gallery of Vanished Husbands was the right title, and that had to stay. And so far, all the publishers around the world have agreed, though I did have a bit of an argument with the Italians. Yeah, so I think it was partly because in Italian, the novel in the Viola was published it was basically the translation was something like The Naughty Fiancé, and it was published with, it was basically a photograph of a woman's sort of décolletage, and I did have a couple of rather strange emails from readers asking if it was me. I was like, no, that's not usually the thing they do. So for the next book, can we have a slightly more sensible cover? And but yeah, so they do change them. Yeah.
How much of Rosie is in this book, and have your in-laws read the book?
Well, I never met Rosie, so really the sort of, I can't give sort of too much away. So I think hopefully her sort of, her spirit is in the book. But Juliet is, you know, she's a rather different character. I mean, she has to be because I don't know Rosie. Mm-hmm. And yes, well, my mother-in-law has read the book and she absolutely loved it. But my father-in-law, he really prefers books on bridge. So I'm really hoping that perhaps he will read this one, but I reckon it's 50-50.
Has he read the other two?
He read Mr. Rosenblum, but because I think it had Mr. in the title, it was sufficiently masculine. And also, he's an incredibly keen golfer, and there's an element of golf in the first book. But there's neither bridge nor golf in the second book, so he really didn't see why it was for him.
What's your next book about?
I'm not ready to talk about the next one yet. I find that sort of books, when I start them, they're fragile things, and you can talk them out of existence really easily. And that kind of impetus to write, if I tell people about it, it's like I've done it already, and then the urge to put it on the page sort of vanishes. So I have to be a little bit careful. It doesn't have a title yet. I usually give my books really silly names in draft. Either Fred, I think the sort of the house at Tyneford was called Fred. And this one actually was Ethel for a while, and Ethel does get a little mention. And it stops my publishers sort of worrying. They often get nervous if you give something a working title that you're going to get too attached for it and really want to call your book that. But giving it a really stupid name, they know that it's not going to, you know.
So it'll be a year, a couple years?
I think it might be. I don't know. I haven't done very much yet.
No pressure.
I also have this small wriggly son, but I think he might have to go into daycare for a little bit come January, because at the moment my husband is also a writer, and we're trying to work with one of us kind of chasing him round and keeping his finger out of the plug sockets whilst the other one writes. But I can sense that perhaps is not a long term solution.
He'll grow out of that.
Yeah, I hope so.
So the House of Tanford, after I finished it, I was still with the book for about a week. It's like the book was, I couldn't let go.
Oh, thank you.
There was something in it that really meant something to me. Did you have somebody in mind when you wrote it? I mean, isn't that you take characters, you build characters from something, somebody you know, or some event that happened?
I think in a way just all my characters are me, whether they're Jack Rosenblum or Elise or Juliet or Leonard and Frida. I feel like they're all aspects of me is the truth. That they're sort of, yes, I kind of take sort of events and details and I have a sense of something, but then kind of spins into fiction, but she's not based on a specific person. I think that a bit of her, I mean, I think there's sort of, certainly at the beginning, I think Elise is quite mischievous, and I think that mischief is taken a bit from my mother when she was young, and the little details of kind of gorging herself on creamy custard and never doing what she's told. Those are the stories that sort of my mother when she was young, and a little bit my grandmother. And some of my family did come across to the UK sort of on domestic service visas in that way. So, yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
I just was wondering if you have, now that you have a one-year-old, if you have a new routine in writing, or if you have, I mean, you were saying your husband kind of takes care of the child while you're writing.
I think that just before, I had the luxury of saying, I'm in the mood to write. You could be a bit pretentious and a bit superstitious about the whole thing. I don't have time for that now. You know, Luke's asleep. I'm at my desk. And if there's time to use the bathroom first, brilliant. But there might not be. And that's all I have. There's no time for anything else. But I think the way it makes you focus is amazing. And I think that sort of some of the writing I've done since Luke's born has actually been more quite tight. So hopefully it will be a good thing.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.